Hello, guys, and welcome back to our series, Help, I'm Under Attack. This is the fifth in a six-part series. Today we're going to consider the topic of hope and hopelessness. I'm sure if you're a fellow that's, say, 30 years of age or older, that you have experienced one or more seasons in your life already that you would describe as very difficult. Now, some seasons, when we call it a season, some are short, some are long. Some men that I know have lived through things for a decade or more, or several decades. Some are still in the process of living through something. For others of us, a season might only be a year or two. But it doesn't really matter, short or long. It's our perception, and our perception in that moment is that this thing is beyond our ability to control, beyond our ability to change, and we feel, and this is an operative word here, powerless. And so powerlessness is one of the symptoms of a life that at the moment feels hopeless. So this morning we're going to consider, how do I maintain hope? Where should hope come from? How do I bolster hope in difficult times? How do I reconcile the facts that are before me with the hope that is within me? How do I balance those two out? When I look out and it really does look bleak, on what am I going to draw that hope? So I believe that this is going to be an encouraging discussion that you'll listen to this morning. Not only that, there's a lot of great scripture. I'm going to, during the teaching time, I'm going to refer to a lot of scripture. If you're following along, I'd really encourage you to get a pen and a pad even before this starts and jot down the scripture references. Write them in maybe a flyleaf in your own Bible, or write them somewhere. Maybe store them on your phone if you have a note app and you keep helpful ideas and helpful scriptures stored as notes in your phone. Do that with this, because some of these are what I would consider to be bedrock scriptures that every man can fall back on during his times of difficulty. I think they'll encourage you. So, men, listen along. Hope you're encouraged. See you again next week. Okay. Now, this is 5 of 6 in this series. After that, we're going to do probably 2, maybe 3 weeks on prayer, and then I haven't quite decided what we're going to do next. I don't know that we've ever done a series on prayer here. I'm not even sure why I'm doing it. It was just something the other week. I was reading through some stuff, and I thought, you know, that's really good. We should talk about that. And I started to jot down some notes, and it became a few weeks after I put some notes together. But the ranks are pretty thin here this morning. So I have a question before we get started. What do we need to do to get some more men out here? Are you still finding this useful? That's maybe an important question to ask. And it's okay to say no. I mean, you know, I know it's hard to look me in the face and say, no, this is really bad. But it's okay. All right. That's a vote of silence. And I'm not ever sure what that means exactly. But you're here, so I'm going to assume that there's some benefit. Either that, or you feel guilty when you're not here. Or it's just a habit and you show up because of that. What do we need to do to get some more men here? Because it takes the same amount of effort to put material together, whether we're doing it for 15 guys or whether we're doing it for 25 guys or whatever. And so my question to you is, if you find it helpful, shouldn't other men find it helpful? And if you don't find it helpful, help me to understand why. And again, this is your time to contribute, so that...
I want to tell you why I came. You went on kind of did a commercial on video, and then one Sunday I think you spoke and you challenged every man that they need this type of thing.
Okay.
So maybe that would help get more men.
So I need to do another commercial.
Another challenge session.
Okay. Jim enjoys doing them with me because he gets to make fun of me for an hour straight. So he always enjoys that opportunity. Well, Jim, perhaps we need to shoot another commercial. That's great. Yeah, maybe we'll get Tony imitating me challenging the men in a commercial. Right. Then we'll need a script writer after that. All right, so that's why you're here. What spoke to you about that?
Well, it's just like, I was pretty new, and I wasn't getting to know people, and I thought this would give me an idea, too, of where the foundation and the basis of this church is, some of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought God was speaking to me that I needed something more than what I was getting Sunday morning, too, also.
Okay.
I wish I could come every week. I can't. I make it when I can. So.
That's fine. Anybody else?
I came to the message that you're doing this 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I came to that. It's like, you know, being a tiny girl in maturity and the Lord and your storm attack. It's overwhelming sometimes.
So I should read into that the. After week 6, which is next week, that you won't be here anymore. Okay. Anybody else? Improvements, changes, suggestions? Do you have friends that could use this? If so, what is standing between them and them being here?
I came back because I needed more. I go to Strawberry Covenant Church, and it doesn't seem like enough, you know, having kids now and being a single dad, having it full time, like I needed something to understand me more.
Okay.
And I just need more time of fellowship and, you know, not get out of that. You know, when we have too much time on our hands, we tend to go places where we don't need to go. And, you know, and that's what I needed, more time with, you know,
Man. Okay.
Talk with them and just have more friends.
There's an interesting phrase that you used that I liked. I needed to understand me more. I don't know if that's grammatically correct, but it really speaks to an issue that a lot of men have. What's going on in the inside? Do I really know why I do what I do? So today we're actually going to look at why we sometimes do exactly what some of you have described. We get on a cycle. Have you ever committed to be engaged in something because you knew it was good for you and you follow through for a little while and you get to the point that you feel, I've got this again, my life is good, and then you start to back off on some of the disciplines that you've developed. And it's almost to the point of, I don't want to say desperation maybe, but you start to feel empty. In other words, you wait until there's nothing left and then you return. Or worse, you wait until you are desperate and then you return. And have you ever lived through a cycle like that? Where I go, I receive, I become engaged for a while, I feel full, I feel rich, I feel that I can manage my life, and then I go back into the routines that I used to have, and then I wait until I'm empty, and I really need this again. And we're going to talk about that today, but we're going to talk about it in the context of hope. Does everybody have a handout by now? And the sign-up sheet has gone around. Did anybody put their name down for the table? For tomorrow? Okay. All right. All right, so we're going to look at the issue of hope. So because this, I think, is going to be extremely practical for you, and because there's a lot of good material, if there's one handout that you don't throw away amongst the others that you probably do, maybe you ought to fold this one up and tuck it away in a Bible or keep it somewhere where you can refer back to it later. So we can actually read together here the first text block there. Hope cannot be taken, it must be surrendered. Question, have you ever felt despondent? Have you ever felt desperate? Have you ever felt hopeless? Who's responsible for that? Okay, that's the right answer, but when you feel that way, do you believe you are? So at the moment when you feel helpless, what is usually your assignment of blame, if you will? Why do we feel this way?
Usually somebody else caused
Okay, so we become, can I say victims? We become victims of circumstances, of people, of maybe ourselves, right? That's almost the worst kind of hopelessness. When I become a victim of my own poor choices and bad behaviors, and now I'm reaping consequences as a result of what I've done, and now I feel desperate. All right, so important thing, hope cannot be taken, it must be surrendered. For a mature follower of Christ, hope is the natural response to circumstances. However, if a man is enticed to doubt, then hope can be laid down or given up. So this is the first principle for everybody to take away. No one can take your hope. You have to give it up. Now, I know that sounds counter to what everybody wants to believe. Now, if you're not a Christ follower, that we might want to say, well, okay, that's a different set of circumstances. Because if you are a Christ follower, what do you have to depend on for hope? If you're not a, okay, if you are a Christ follower, if you're not a Christ follower, what do you have to depend on? Okay, yourself? Part of your, which is part of yourself, okay, what else?
Friends,
sure. All right. Here's the problem. Do you trust yourself? You should, to an extent. Do you trust yourself? Yeah. Have you ever failed yourself? Do you trust your friends? Have friends ever failed you? So when you are a man without Christ in his life, hope is possible, but it depends more on you and the resources that you have available to you. When you are a follower of Christ, in theory, you have the hope of all of the power and the authority of God behind you. And I say in theory because most of us really don't live that way. So, since you've been a believer, has there ever been a season of great despair that you've entered into? What happens at those times? What do we give up? What are we not doing that causes us to despair? And what I'm asking you to do is to think through this. What are we honestly saying if we're Christ followers and we end up in a season of hopelessness? Okay, that's part of it. What else? We're going to get to that, and that could occupy the whole morning. But we're going to talk about that. Come on, what are we saying? My problem is bigger than God. The God that I serve is either A, not trustworthy, or B, not powerful enough. Maybe He doesn't love me anymore. Maybe He's cast me aside. So in some way or another, when we set into a season of hopelessness after we become believers, what we're saying is, I can no longer trust God completely with my life. And so we give hope away. All right, so let's read through a little bit more of this. There's some of this that we're just going to read together because I'm going to tell you, while it took me a long time to prepare this, I didn't commit it all to memory so that I can deliver it. So we're just going to go through this together. Biblical hope, then, is even more. It is not only the internal response of one's mind and emotion coming together in agreement that the situation is not greater than the individual. In other words, it is not just me saying I'm more powerful than this situation, but also that God is greater than all circumstances and individuals. All right. So what are some of the advantages that we come into life with? And it's interesting that we are kind of programmed to be hope-filled. Has anyone ever heard the phrase, will to live? It's typically ascribed to human beings that we're all born with a will to live, that we're all born with a survival instinct, and that it is our natural state of existence to want to survive. And yet, we can come to the point where even that isn't a functioning and valid response in our lives. We become so desperate that we don't care anymore. What brings that about? Okay, he said isolation. And we're going to look at that. As a matter of fact, why don't we just start right now? Let's all turn over to Psalm 42. So the first principle, well, you're turning over to Psalm 42, and we're actually going to go through the entire chapter, so you don't need to worry about a particular verse. If the first principle is that hope is not something that can be taken from you, that you have to give it up, then the second principle is this, that hope is a renewable resource, and unless you are actively engaged in constantly renewing within you your ability to believe, then you are ultimately setting yourself up for a season of hopelessness. So here's three things for these bullet points. We're going to read them together. Both hope and hopelessness begin with belief. That's it. The source of whether you hope or whether you doubt, whether you're confident in a situation or whether you lack confidence, whether you believe all is lost or whether you believe that there is a possible good outcome, all that starts with belief. Beliefs are grown and cared for and strengthened. So here's a question. Has a belief of yours ever come under attack? Has something that you truly believe in ever been assaulted? Have your doubts ever called your beliefs to question? Come on. Of course they have. Let's go all the way back to the garden. What was the seed planted? If we were to paraphrase what the serpent's enticement to Eve was, what was it?
Deception.
It was deception. Does God really want what's best for you, or is God holding out on you? Is there something more that God has kept back from you? You cannot trust God to give you the best. You have to go out and get it for yourself. And therefore, everything that you and I hold dear, this is a natural assumption that every one of us should make, and I think it is foreign to most men. Anything that you truly believe in is going to come under attack. Why wouldn't it? Every belief that you hold dear is sooner or later going to be put to the test. It is going to come under attack. And so you need to be really confident about why you believe what you believe. It's that simple. All right. So the real question is not, can I have hope? What's going to cause me to give up hope? And that's what you and I want to know. What are the telltale signs that we should be looking for in our lives that are saying, I am at a point where I could easily abandon hope? So let's go, we're going to read through Psalm 42 here. If you have, most of you have an actual hard copy Bible here. This is a great chapter. I'm going to give you some Psalms to go through here and save. This is one of these ones that should be in your personal library of go-tos. So I would really mark this up, fold it. If you keep notes in the front or the back of a Bible where you say this is a go-to thing, put some notes there for yourself. As with a lot of familiar texts, sometimes we gloss over them and we don't get the real meat out of it. So as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, the living God. When can I go and meet with God? Now, I'm assuming that if you've been in the church for a while, you've heard that verse. What's being said there? Incidentally, it is okay to have an answer. Okay. Any other ideas? Okay. What kind of a desire? It's not just a desire. It is the desire. Okay, let's read it again together. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, the living God. When can I go and meet with God? Now he uses his metaphor and he says, in the same way that a deer would thirst for water. And so he's envisioning this picture of a deer. It's been running for a long time. It's exhausted. It's really craving water. What's he saying? Well, he's describing the situation that every single human being experiences. I don't thirst until I am empty. What's allowed me to get to the point that I'm empty? See, you can't thirst unless you're dehydrated, unless you're parched. Now look at what he says next. My tears have been my food day and night, while men say to me all day long, where is your God? And so he starts to address the why he feels empty, why he wants God. This is not just, like some people read this and they think, you know, I don't think I could ever feel that. I'm not one of these over-the-top religious types. I don't know that I could thirst after God that much. But David is not talking about this in the context of, oh, I just can't wait to sit down and have fellowship with God. What he's saying is, I am desperate. I am in need. Everything within me is empty, and God is my only hope, and now I finally realize it. My tears have been my food day and night. Again, metaphorical. What's he really saying? Why? It's the tears thing. Why? What do the tears represent?
Desperation.
Have you ever been in this situation? All night long, I can't sleep, and all I think about are my problems. All I think about are the difficult situations in my life. My fear keeps me awake. My worry keeps me awake. My doubts and my concerns keep me awake. Have you ever been awake at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 in the morning? You cannot go to sleep. And that's what he's saying. All night long, my doubts consume me. And so what do you hope for? Maybe I'll get up in the morning, I'll be tired, right? I'll be exhausted, but I'll get out of this house and I'll go be around other people and maybe I'll forget what I'm worrying about then. Have you ever thought that? But what does he say? My tears have been my food when? All day and all night. So look at what he says. My tears have been my food day and night, while men say to me all day long, where is your God? So I spend time at home at night. I can't get a good night's sleep. I am consumed with worry, so I think I'm going to go out and I'm going to escape and I'm going to be in the presence of other humans and it'll help me to forget my problem. And what happens when I'm in the presence of other humans? They remind you of your problems. That's exactly it. And if they don't remind you by what they say, they remind you by how nice their lives look. You know what I'm talking about. I'm the only one dealing with... Joe's problems don't seem to be a big deal. Look at Sam over there. His life is golden. His life is going great. Am I the only one? And now what happens? If your life is going good, and your life is going good, and your life is going good, and mine's the only one that's going bad, you get bitter? Is God mad at me? Does God not love me anymore? What's up with me? Why me? Okay, maybe you don't ask it that way. Maybe you do. Why me? These things I remember as I pour out my soul. How I used to go with the multitude, leading the procession to the house of God, with shouts of joy and thanksgiving among the festive throng. And I think in that there's almost a bitter memory there. Have you ever been the person before you have gone through a season of doubt, a season of despair, and you didn't understand what that felt like? And you were happy and you could not understand how anybody could be caught in a season of desperation? Have you ever just said they should snap out of it? No?
Sure.
Yeah, some people do. And reflecting back on this, he's saying, you know, I used to be that guy. I used to not understand what it felt like. I used to be at the front of the line. I used to be, yay God, go God. God's awesome. And everybody else was trailing behind. I was like the ultimate God cheerleader. But now I find myself in a situation where I'm not so sure anymore. And now I actually understand these other people that had doubts and concerns. And then right there in the middle of this, and if you're the kind that marks up a Bible, right there between at the end of verse 4 and before chapter or verse 5 starts, you could draw a line because there is an immediate reversal. He finally catches himself It's like he has been in free fall emotionally for quite a while. And then he asks this question, why are you downcast, my soul? Why so disturbed within me? Remember that question that BJ said? I need to know who I am. I'm sometimes not sure what's going on in the inside of me. This is the question. Why are you so downcast, my soul? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God. For I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God. And this is the way it is with us. What's the next verse say? My soul is downcast within me. Back and forth. Back and forth. Back and forth. I see a reason to be optimistic for a second. And then I remember my problems again. And then I'm optimistic. Maybe God can help. But then, the doubts rise up again. Maybe God doesn't like... Maybe God is powerful enough, but maybe I'm not worthy. Maybe He doesn't love me. Whatever it is. And so there's this agonizing wrestling that goes on back and forth. God can help. Maybe God won't help. God could help. But maybe He doesn't think I deserve the help. Maybe God's helped me so many times that I think I'm beyond God's help because God has just flat out given up on me. It's like maybe there's a limit to how many times God helps you before He just kicks you to the curb and abandons you. Let me read this again. My soul is downcast within me. Therefore, I will remember you from the land of Jordan, the heights of Hermon, and from Mount Mizar. Deep calls to deep in the roar of your waterfalls. Remember how he starts out as the deer pants for water. And now he returns to this idea, only now he says deep calls to deep, which means the inner voice of God speaking to the deepest longings of who I am and what I want to know. How much water is there in a waterfall? He says when he finally hears the voice of God for a moment, it's not just a trickle, it's not just a small stream, it's an immense torrent. The encouragement and the hope of God when it finally comes is a lot. He can hear it from a distance. He can actually hear it before he can smell it, before he can finally drink it in. All of your waves and breakers have swept over me. And then look at his attitude here. By day, the Lord directs His love, and at night, His song is with me. So now what's happened? Remember how he starts out? Day and night, he can't escape what's going on. Now look at his attitude. By day the Lord directs His love, and at night His song is with me. And so I say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Why must I go about mourning, oppressed by the enemy? Isn't that interesting how quickly we move from condition to condition? And we're going to talk about that because there's three things that we need to address as men when we get into a hopeless situation. And the first of them is our emotions. And I'm going to say this right now. If you are not regularly caring for your emotional condition, you're setting yourself up for seasons of disappointment. Have you ever been disappointed at yourself for the roller coaster of your emotions? Up one day, down the next, up the next, down. Can't seem to get on an even keel. And if you do not feed yourself with reasons for hope on a regular basis, you're headed for that disappointment. And yet, this is the dilemma here. What does the deer have to do before it's thirsty? It has to deplete itself of everything that's in it. You don't want anything more to drink when you've got what you think is enough. And so this is the irony. As long as I think I'm full, I don't want any more. And what he's saying is, in this case, it's almost as if I have to get to bone dry parched before I finally get to the point that I guess I need to drink. But for the rest of your life, you're going to go through this cycle again and again and again if you wait until you sense you're thirsty before you drink. So the only cure for this, and I know this sounds like a broken record that we say again and again, you got to be regularly, faithfully in some form of personal care practice. Now, we often say read the Bible and pray or have some, but I'm not even saying that. I'm saying you need personal spiritual care practices, whatever they are, to renew and restore your hope, because even though hope is something that you have to surrender, it can't be taken from you. Remember, principle number one. Principle number two is that hope is a depletable resource, and if you do not renew it regularly, you're going to empty yourself of it. Okay, so the three questions. What am I facing? What am I feeling? What am I thinking? And then the final one, for which there is no answer, maybe, why is this happening? So incidentally, if you haven't yet, I'm going to ask you to think of a desperate time in your past. And you know what my assumption is here? And I shouldn't have to make this assumption, but I think it's true. Chances are you're really not going through anything horrendous right now, or you wouldn't be here. Do you know why? It's exactly what he said. Do you remember what you said? Yeah, because when things get really bad, you don't want to be around anybody else, and you usually isolate. Because the last thing you need is more people to, A, either remind you of how bad your life is because theirs seems so good, or it's a pride thing, and it's like, I don't want anybody to know how bad my life is. It's easy to brag about your life when it's going well, right? Who wants to go around saying, boy, my life really sucks? So what am I facing? And that's usually the thing we focus on first. What we think are the facts in front of us. And what I'm going to encourage us all to do is put the facts at a distance for a moment and let's care for our emotions. So here it is, we confront facts, we nurture feelings to bring them into line with what is most advantageous for us, and then finally we guard and guide our thinking. We'll come back to David in the middle of the night. Have you ever let your thoughts just run crazy? The what ifs? You know what I'm saying? Well, if I miss this payment, maybe I won't be able to, right? And if that happens, then maybe it'll come for the house, and maybe it'll come for the car, and or if I show up for work 15 minutes late because I have a flat tire, then maybe they'll fire me. And if they fire me, then I won't be able to pay my bills, and if they can't pay my bills, then I'll be on the street. And if I'm on the street, then I'll, you know what I'm saying? Right? Maybe your thoughts run amok, go in a different way, but don't we all do that? So if you and I do not guard and guide our thinking, our creativity will overwhelm us. Let's turn over to Psalm 18. We'll start at the beginning of the chapter. And we're not going to read much of it. This is another one. Put it in your library. Everybody needs a personal library of go-to chapters. This is a good one. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer. My God is my rock in whom I take refuge. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call to the Lord who is worthy of praise, and I am saved from my enemies. What are the names that you refer to God by? Who is God to you?
Father, Father.
Okay. Who is God to this psalmist? Look at these powerful words that he uses to describe God. Do you remember what we said? The only difference between the believer and the, we'll call him a not yet believer, in terms of hope, the only advantage the believer has is his confident trust in God. So who is your God? Not who is the God, but who is your God? Is your God the God? Is your God a rock, a shield, a horn of salvation, a fortress, a rock? Is he all of that? Who is your God? Let's turn over to Isaiah 9:6. Because you say, we follow Jesus. Well, who is Jesus? And sometimes Jesus sounds like just a calm, sort of tranquil guy. Again, we know these texts, but we don't always put them into play. Okay, this is like Christmas time stuff. All right, but we're going to drag the Christmas time verses out right now because they're important. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. This is our Jesus. And the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, and he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Does that sound like a weak Jesus? See, it's not just enough to say, well, I trust God. Who is your God? What are the adjectives that you use to describe him? Because your emotional state depends on it. So write down it at the core of what you think about God. Ask yourself this: how strong, how powerful, how capable is your God? Not the God, because the reality is you worship your God. Whether you worship the God, I don't know. But you worship your God. And so until your God is the God, your God might be less than all of this. Let's turn over to Psalm 40. We'll start at the beginning again. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit. All right, so can we agree that the guy, at least in the guy's mind, whether this is fact or whether this is perception, we don't know. Can we agree that the guy at least thinks he's in a bad situation? How does he describe himself? Stuck in a slimy pit. All right, so we'd agree that at least in his mind, he's in a bad situation. And yet, how does he describe his emotional state there? He's waiting patiently. For whom can you wait patiently? Not frantically, not desperately. For whom could you wait patiently? Patiently. Could you wait patiently for someone that you wasn't sure was going to show up? Now, it's interesting the situation he describes himself in. Have you ever been in mud that the more you work to get your way out of it, it seemed like the deeper and the stucker you got? Have you ever been in one of those? I mean, it's not like everyday mud is like that, but there are situations where the more frantically you try to get out of a situation, the deeper and deeper you get into it. And so what he's saying, if you're waiting patiently in a situation like that, what have you done? You've trusted in the Lord and abandoned a frantic pursuit to get yourself out of a situation by means that are only making your situation worse. But could you wait patiently for a God that might not show up? Have you ever called a friend in a desperate situation, but it's the kind of a friend, maybe your car broke down or whatever, but it's the kind of a guy that you're never sure if he's going to show up. Have you ever called that guy? And you're looking for a backup guy to call just in case, because you kind of know that the guy you really called, who was the only guy who answered the phone at that time, was not your first choice to go to, but he's the only guy who picked up the phone.
And he didn't show up.
Right. And so the whole time, you're not waiting patiently. You're playing out in your mind what you're going to do and how you're going to get home when this guy doesn't show up. The only person you wait patiently for is the person that you are confident is going to arrive. And he lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire, and he set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. And he put a new song in my mouth and a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. And so the outcome of that is what? We have reason to be thankful to God. So let me encourage every one of you right now, don't offer cheap praise to God in public. Now, I know that sounds counter to what you may have heard, but listen, when you say, I thank God for delivering me out of the miry pit, and that's your testimony, who knows who's listening and needs that next week? So be real, okay? If you delivered yourself out of the miry pit, you don't need to give praise to God. But if you really were in a miry pit, then I want to know about it, because I need to know in my moment of desperation if the God that got you out of the miry pit is that God, and if I might be able to count on Him. So if you're always running around with cheap and insincere praise to God, but you've never had an experience where you actually were in a miry pit and God got you out of it, then please just be quiet. Because my lifeline might just be what you tell me that I'm going to wait patiently for. And I want to make sure that what I'm waiting patiently for is something that's worth waiting for. But then if God has delivered you out of the miry pit, then I need to know about it. And we all need to know about it. And that's one of the reasons why we get together. Because I guess I could borrow this and adapt it to this situation. In terms of miry pits, we're either in one, we're about to walk into one, or we're getting our way out of one. Right? That's the way it is with miry pits, which is pretty much the messes of our lives. And sometimes we're in more than one at a time. Ron and I might be the only guys in the room old enough to know that. All right. This one might be worth reading. If you have already surrendered hope, remember this, your God is the source of ultimate hope. And so hope was really not yours to give up. Go get it back. Take hold of it and guard it carefully. You are the steward of the hope that is in you, but that hope is the hope of God and not your own. Here's a question that you should ask yourself. If something horrendous were to happen to you by 12 noon today, what is the quotient and the condition of the hope that is within you? Could it withstand an assault? What have you done to nurture and care for the hope that is within you in the last 24 hours? And I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not telling you, well, you need to read this devotional or do that. You're all big guys, right? You've been around the block a few times before. I don't need to spoon feed you this. I'm just going to call you out and say, what are you doing to make sure that the hope that is within you is firm, it is vigorous, it is robust, and it is able to handle the assault? Let's turn over to 1 Peter. Incidentally, you're a most untalkative group today. What is up with that? All right. Verses that we've read before. See, there's good stuff in verses that we read again and again, and the problem is that we just read through them. We take one thing away from them. There might be half a dozen good things. 13th verse, 3rd chapter. Who's going to harm you if you are eager to do good? Stop right there. This is Peter writing, and he's writing to people who are in the midst of difficult situations. And so what do you think? They hear this question. What do you think their response is? Who's going to harm you if you go about doing good. And it's like, bang! Let me tell you, Peter. Let me tell you about my life. Yeah, just because I do good things doesn't mean good things are happening to me. And so even before they could say, yeah, but, he says, but even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. But in your heart, set Christ as Lord. What does it mean to, in your heart, set Christ as Lord? It's got to be pretty important, because he says that the whole reason that they should not be frightened like everyone else around them. See what he said? Do not fear what they fear. Who is they? Everybody else who doesn't have Christ as the Lord of their life. Everybody else who doesn't have Christ as the Lord of their life is apparently, they've got good reason to be scared. So what is it about Christ as Lord in my heart that could possibly make the difference? What does that mean?
He's your source of hope.
He's your source of hope. What's your heart? You're not wrong, incidentally. What's your heart in Peter's way of thinking, in that way of thinking? We've talked about this before. Yeah, Bill nods his head. Yes, I remember. We did talk about that before. Now, what did we say when we talked about that before? It's your seat of reason and thinking. It is the source point of all of your decisions. So when we're told to guard our hearts, what are we guarding? The way in which we think. Remember the question that I asked before? I said, first, we need to care for our emotions. That's the first thing. Before you face the facts, care for your emotions. The next thing is, I need to equip my thinking. That's the second step. So guard and secure my emotions, and now equip my thinking. So if my heart is the source of all of my reason and thought, then who's at the center of my heart's process? And Peter, in this verse, who is Peter saying needs to be, and as whom? Jesus as Lord. Remember the terms that we said before? God is my rock, God is my salvation, God is my deliverer, God is all these powerful words, these triumphant words. And here Peter says, Christ as Lord in your heart. So who is your Christ? Is your Christ capable? Is your Christ greater than the problems around you? And is he really Lord of your heart? Is he the governing factor in the way you think, or do you have two trains of thought going at the same time? Remember what I asked, have you ever let your thinking run wild? And when that happens, who's Lord of your reasoning? I am, right? I'm Lord of my reasoning when I let my thoughts run crazy. But in your heart, set Christ apart, or set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the hope that you have. Now, I know the way we read this usually, and we say, well, that means that when somebody on the street comes up and says, why do you act the way you act? And well, I trust Jesus. But he's saying, when the crap hits the fan, and everyone has a good, healthy, rational reason to be afraid, you should be the only person in the room who is not fearful. And when everybody else around you looks at you and says, are you nuts? Do you know how bad this situation is? Why aren't you afraid? That's what he's saying. He says, at that time, you should have some explanation for why it is that you aren't afraid. Who do you have to explain why you're not afraid to first before you can explain it to anybody else? Yes, you do, don't you? So you have to have carefully conditioned and prepared your heart and your thinking, and you have to rationally understand why it is that you do not have reason to be deathly afraid. Now, there is a natural sort of normal fear, right? We all have a sense of apprehension about something, right? I mean, if I see the truck coming at me at 80 miles an hour and it's 15 feet from my face, I will probably be momentarily fearful. That's a healthy response. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a consuming fear about what might happen that gives no definite guaranteed evidence that it will happen. And when everyone else around us is fearful, when we could be fearful, we have to condition our hearts, put Christ as Lord at the center of our reasoning, and allow that to guide our thinking. Now, do we have any questions, comments?
You know, you said about guarding your heart and stuff like that. You know, Joe from Monday Night Men's Bible Study.
Mm-hmm.
He said he saw a certain tattoo, and it said, "If you guard your spirit, your demons will starve." And I thought that was
That is good.
Yeah.
That really is good. Yeah. All right. Okay, so now we're going to come back into renewing your thinking again. Before you can address the problem, that's the one last thing to address. Before you can address the problem, you should first be grounded in what you believe about each of the other resources that you have here. All right, what do you believe about yourself? And you can take an inventory of this. So remember, if you've already given your mind a license to run wild in the past, because you haven't placed Christ at the center of your reasoning, and we all do this, incidentally. I'm not casting criticism on anybody. I'm very familiar with this. As a matter of fact, the reason I can speak comfortably about this is because I know it from firsthand experience. Right? And the challenge, and some of you will appreciate this, the challenge about being really creative is you can come up with really creative bad scenarios for what's going to happen. The more gifted you are in creativity, the worse the story you can tell yourself about your future. It's almost great to be uncreative at times like this because at least you're not very imaginative about the bad things that could happen to you. So here's a question. What do you believe about yourself? What do you believe about the resources that you have? Sometimes we forget this, and now we're moving from spiritual care and care of your reasoning to actually taking an inventory. What do you have? What's at your disposal? Because at times when we're desperate, we're unlikely to be positively and helpfully creative. Because all of our creativity is consumed in creating the scenario of the bad that is about to happen. So have you ever had to have somebody come alongside of you and remind you of the resources that were available to you? Because you tend to forget. But what if somebody's not there? Remember what you said again? What do we tend to do? We tend to isolate. So if that's our normal condition, when things are bad, then who's going to be there to remind us of what might be available to us? Nobody but ourselves. So what do you believe about yourself? What do you believe about the resources? What do you believe about others? And then finally, what do you believe about God? Okay. Couple other verses. Philippians 1. I'd like to tell you that I know precisely why I have that in there, but I guess we're both going to be pleasantly surprised when we get there. Okay. For I know that through your prayers and the help given by the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. Okay, so now I remember why it's in there. So, Paul finds himself in a bad situation. Right? He's in prison, he's writing to the Philippians from prison. He's already told them that in fact, this bad thing that is bad for him right now is turning around to be good because there's other people that are being helped. And he has had opportunities while he's in prison that he wouldn't have had any other way. And so he is choosing to see the best in a situation rather than the worst. Incidentally, this is another one of the things that we all need to do that it, this concerns putting Christ at the center of our reasoning. Because when I am at the center of my own reasoning, whose comfort is paramount in my life? Of course it is. Why would it not be? Why would I not want what's comfortable and easy and profitable and good for me? But when Christ is the Lord of my life, and His reasoning is at the center of my reasoning, it's possible that I'll begin to see that it is not always my comfort that's the ultimate objective. I mean, can you imagine Christ saying to Himself, "This is not going well for me, something must be wrong. I must be out of the will of God because my life is difficult." Can you imagine Jesus saying that? "God must be really mad with me because look at where I find myself." And so remember, you may be where you are intentionally as part of God's plan because that is the only way that God can accomplish what He wants to do. But wouldn't it be a shame if you missed the good that could have come out of that because you were an emotional and a mental wreck the whole time because you had no confidence in God? And so I want to take you back to think about Joseph. Opportunity after opportunity in Joseph's life. I mean, one thing after another goes bad, goes bad, goes bad. What is Joseph's response in every single situation? Okay, really, seriously, somebody has to say, huh? You sound like that, like you remember or memorized that or something. Can you repeat? Can you repeat that slowly? Okay. All right, so that's what's going on in his mind. How does he respond then? Courageously, resourcefully? He takes every situation that he finds himself in and applies who he is as a human being and his character, and he excels. In other words, he deploys the gifts that are within him, gifts of leadership, and it's apparent, it's evident that Joseph is a leader. And so in every negative situation where he's faced with feeling bad for himself, doubting God, and believing that he's stuck and the whole plan for his life is ruined, that's his one option, or saying, "I can creatively find ways to deploy my leadership gifts even in the situation that I'm in." All right, now from a purely selfish perspective, I'm saying just think about Joseph and his contentment and his satisfaction. Which way would you rather go through life in prison? Taking control of what you could and rising to a leadership position within the prison, or sitting there and moping? Which would you rather do? You know, one of the biggest reasons why we feel hopeless is because we feel powerless. I have no control, I have no capability, everything of mine has been stripped from me and other people are in control of my life. And we describe this as being, I am the victim, right? So if that's the victim mentality, then the conqueror's mentality says that even in this bad situation, there are certain things that are under my control, within my influence, and everything that is within my influence, I am going to use and I am going to excel even in this bad situation. All right, so even if everybody around you thinks you're deluded, dude, you're in a jam, what's the condition of your mind and heart going to be at that time? If you feel in control and you feel some power over your situation, what's the state of your mind and heart going to be? Are y'all deep in thought or do you just not understand the question? Do you see what I'm saying? We victimize ourselves. There is no time in your life, there is no experience that you and I will go through that we do not have some control over something. Even if it's only the attitude that we bring into and take with us through the difficult situation. All right, no man can endure forever, but every man can endure for the next hour. So even in difficult situations, endure in the moment. Thinking about enduring forever saps a man's strength that he needs to endure for the moment. So that's worth considering. When your creative mind starts to think about how long you're going to need to suffer, when your creative mind starts to think about how you're a month behind on the mortgage and that means that within a few months you're going to be living under a bridge somewhere, just put it at bay. You can endure whatever you're going through for the next minute. You can endure whatever you're going through for the next hour. And God's strength, we're told, is renewed within us how often? Daily, consistently. And can I even say we need it more than daily? Does your mental attitude, do your emotions swing more than a cycle of a day? Do they sometimes swing in 15 minutes? Yeah, they do. All right. Something that each of us has to do then. Now you finally face the facts, so you look at the ledger. And I put it in a ledger term. So on the one side, here are the negatives. Here's what I'm going through. Here's a desperate situation. Here's all the bad stuff. You may as well get it out there. Okay? Remember, you've already prepared your emotions and you've steeled your thinking. Christ is now at the center of your reasoning and thinking. Christ is the Lord. He is all those things. Your rock, your deliverer. Okay, now you're ready to look at the ledger. Have you ever not opened the letter that came in the mail because you knew what was in it? Or am I the only one that has not opened the letter because I already knew what was in it? Come on! Why? Because I wasn't ready to. But once you have prepared your emotions and once you have equipped your thinking, then you are ready to face reality the way it really is. Until that time, you're not. That's why we start. Deal with your emotions. Deal with your thinking. Now let's come to the facts. Because now you're ready to look at the facts. Now you're ready to open the envelope. Now you're ready to have the conversation. Now you're ready to visit the doctor and deal with the report that you're afraid you're going to get. Because now you are ready to look at the facts. Okay, so put the facts down on one side of the ledger. But on the other side of the ledger, you need to put the things that are your resources, the things that you can count on. What do you have going for you? And fill that side of the ledger. And that's a personal journey. But at times like that, that is why we come together. Don't isolate. Because now you're ready to meet with somebody. Now you have prepared yourself. Now you can sit down across the table from somebody and share what's going on in your life. And allow them to be a resource in your life. All right, finally a couple of things. We'll look at these final seven questions here. As you're going through this difficult situation, is there a lesson to learn? Is there something that you can gain from this experience that you could gain in no other way? And wouldn't it be a shame to waste that? Is there something that you can learn about yourself? Is there something you can learn about life? Is there something you can learn about people? And other people's dilemmas. Do you ever walk around thinking that everybody else pretty much has it going on and it's going well in their life? Because you only know them superficially? And because of that, here's the interesting thing. A little something is going bad in our life and we look at everybody else and we know intimately what's going on inside our own lives, but we only know shallowly what is going on in other people's lives, and so we think they have it better than we do and we're the only ones going through a difficult situation. How can we ever empathize with the difficulties of other people? But once you understand that you have the game face that you put on, just the same as everybody else does, while your life is in the miry pit on the inside, then you can be a little bit more attuned and a little bit more sensitive to the other people around you who may be stuck in their own miry pit while all looks good for them on the outside. So even though the guy's driving the new car, living in the nice house, got the hot-looking wife, and he's got the big paycheck coming in, can you be stuck in a miry pit something while all that's going on in your life as the exteriors? You bet you can. But when you're caught up in your own problem, and all you know are the internal realities of your life that nobody else sees, you think that everybody else's externals indicate that they're going through a great season while you're going through a hard one. But learn this from your experience in the pit. It can look good to other people on the outside while it's bad for you. And the same is true for them. Is there a character trait to develop while you're going through this difficulty? Is there an opportunity to discover? Is the seed of something good? Is the seed of a new ministry? Is the seed of a new business? Is the seed of something else in this desperate time? Is there a discipline to be developed? Remember what we talked about, the idea of building hope daily. Well, when your life is going well, is it easy to forget God? Let's be honest. How will you develop the discipline of relying on God daily if you tend to forget God in the good time? So when is it likely that you're going to learn that discipline? Of course. Ron, thank you. You seem to be the only person in the room with a mouth. I don't know what's happened today, but thank you.
One that usually never speaks is speaking.
Well, that's good. That's good. I need somebody. Is there a belief being tested? Remember what we said, that belief is at the source point of your hope or your hopelessness, and every powerful major belief in your life sooner or later is going to be assaulted. Everyone. Wouldn't you want to know truly what you believe? At a core level, wouldn't you want to know what you believe? And the only way you're going to find that out is when it's put to the test. How many of you have ever said, I really trust God with my whole life? Until. There's only one way you will find out what you truly believe. And I got to say this, this is easy for me to say. It's extremely difficult to find out. But since you're going to be in the pit for a while you're waiting patiently in the miry clay, you might as well use your time while you're waiting patiently for something good. So get every bit of good you can out of the pit. Is there a besieging sin to release? Is there something you just need to confess? Maybe you've put yourself in the pit. I mean, that's really an uncomfortable situation to find yourself in the pit. And while you're there, patiently waiting to be extricated from the pit, you have to come to the conscious awareness that there's only one reason that you're in the pit today, and that's because you put yourself there. But wouldn't it be good to learn that lesson now? Wouldn't it be good to give up that sin now? Wouldn't it be good, at least, as uncomfortable as it is, and remember, we said we don't look at the facts until we've prepared our emotions and steeled our thinking. But now that you're prepared for that, wouldn't it be good to look inside yourself and say, I'm the reason I'm here? And I don't want to be in another pit 5 years from now and another one 10 years after that. And as a matter of fact, I don't want to take my family into a pit. So wouldn't it be good to discover what's going on in your heart right now and get rid of it? And finally, is there someone to be served? Even while you're in the pit, look around. Remember Joseph. Even in the pit, chances are, when you adjust your eyes, when your eyes become adjusted to the darkness of the pit, and when you wipe the slime out of your eyes a little bit, chances are you'll find other people that are trapped near you. So you may as well be useful while you're in the pit, too. All right.